From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette. I'm Greta Johnson. We did it. We made it to another weekend. Here is a fun fact to start off the show. Did you know that a group of porcupines is called a prickle? How delightful is that? Coming up, we'll take a deep dive into the book publishing supply chain. Turns out it's kind of a disaster.
Yep, every single step.
There aren't as many mills as there used to be. They've all shut down. They're going bankrupt.
It's going to be an issue for sure. Don't ignore it.
But first, it's our panel to unpack the week. With us, we have the host of the podcast, Fake the Nation, Nagin Farsad. Nagin, hello.
Oh my gosh, a prickle? I had no idea, and now I'm going to try and say it every single day of my life.
It's just so good. Also, here is the host of the Sporkful podcast and the inventor of a whole new pasta, Dan Pashman. Dan, hello.
Hey, Greta, great to see you.
Okay, so I think we should start with kid vaxes, because you two are both parents, and nearly a million kids around the country received their first round of Pfizer shots this week. You both have children. Dan, yours are old enough for the vaccine, right?
Yes, I have an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old.
Okay. So have you gotten to sign them up yet?
They are actually getting vaccinated right now as we
speak. No, that's amazing.
Yes, it's happening this very moment.
So how do you feel?
I feel excited. I feel really good about it. They finally just got over their fear of shots well enough to like not cause a total disaster.
I was going to say those are good ages for that. Yeah.
So I think it will provide some nice relief.
Yeah. So Nagin, how old is your kid?
Mine is only 2.5, so she's not eligible yet.
Have you thought about getting a fake ID for her, Nagin?
I'm excited that every other kid is doing it because she's in a preschool, and there are 5 and 6 year olds at our school, so it's like right. The fewer opportunities for the thing to spread. I mean, it ends up protecting the vulnerable and then the little ones.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. So unfortunately, due to timing, none of the roughly 28 million children who are now eligible are going to be fully vaccinated by Thanksgiving. But have you made Thanksgiving plans, Dan?
We're hosting our extended family,
and
everyone will be either fully vaccinated or kids who are at least partially vaccinated. So I think we feel good about that.
That's awesome. So, Dan, I mentioned that you are a pasta inventor. Are you going to serve the pasta at Thanksgiving?
You know,
That's a great question, because it's not. It is not a Thanksgiving food, Dan.
No.
Excuse me.
I guess maybe mac and cheese.
Yes. Mac and cheese is a common Thanksgiving side dish in many parts of the country.
Excuse me, he says.
And my pasta-shaped cascatelli goes quite well with my wife's mac and cheese recipe, which is fantastic.
So you're going to do it.
Yeah.
Dan, you took that really like an insult, and things almost came to blows on the Nerdette podcast.
I felt insulted on behalf of mac and cheese.
So, Nagin, what are your Thanksgiving plans? Are you doing anything fun?
Our Thanksgivings are just like a grab bag of wild. Like, one year we'll do pizza. Another year we'll actually order a Thanksgiving feast from a place. I've ventured to make a bunch of side dishes, but I've never made an actual turkey. It's completely a who knows what's going to happen. But we kind of find that exciting.
Well, then in that case, pasta would totally work for your Thanksgiving household, Nagin.
You know what? And I have to be honest with you, Dan. Now that you're saying this, I literally did, like, I ordered a mac and cheese once for Thanksgiving from a mac and cheese spot in New York City called Smack. So that was literally one of my Thanksgiving meals was a straight up mac and cheese. So I apologize to everyone who felt offended.
Okay.
So in other news this week, People magazine named Paul Rudd the sexiest man alive. The 52-year-old actor from Clueless, Ant-Man, and the forthcoming Ghostbusters Afterlife went on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert to make the big reveal.
I'm the sexiest man alive!
You're the sexiest man alive!
I'm the sexiest man alive!
So this was an interesting one. I saw a little bit of Twitter discourse about it. A lot of people were like, sexiest man alive, though, which got us wondering. I mean, I don't know. I'm not mad about this decision. What do y'all think? Nagin, is Paul Rudd the sexiest living man?
Okay, so I feel strongly that he is a good-looking man. He's like a cute man. He's like a slightly nerdy man. But I think self-described. I don't think this is any, me casting shade.
Oh, yeah, no.
But I don't think he's, like, sexy. You know what? I was looking at the list of previous winners. I mean, Idris Elba's on there. You know what I mean? Brad Pitt is on there. Are they at the same level? Is Paul Rudd at their level? And this, it made me worry a little bit that Sexiest Man Alive, such an important distinction every year, and it's up there with the Nobel Prize for me, that I was worried that we're sort of like, what's the word? We're undermining it by going in this kind of more cuddly route, cuddly nerd route. Now, that said, I would do Paul Rudd. Just to be clear, this isn't about me not doing Paul Rudd. I would, okay? Gun to my head, I'll do it.
Okay, okay.
I'm just saying I don't know that he's on the level of some of these other sexy beings.
That's amazing. What do you think, Dan? Are you concerned that the integrity of Sexiest Man Alive is being compromised with this decision?
Look, Paul Rudd is a white Jewish, middle-aged dad of two who was born in New Jersey.
Oh.
As somebody who also fits all those criteria,
okay.
I think this is a fantastic choice. I say more Paul Rudds, fewer Idris Elbas.
I have to say, I think Dan is actually making my point, which is if you're a man in America, you should essentially not see yourself in the Sexiest Man Alive. Okay.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. Look, hashtag cuddly nerds. All right. That's let's get that brand going.
I don't know. I just really like, I've always had a soft spot for Paul Rudd, and like that People article, the little interview he did about being the Sexiest Man Alive, obviously he thinks it's ridiculous. Like, he talks about how his friends are going to make fun of him. He had this great line about how, like, he's hoping now that he'll finally be invited to some of these sexy dinners with Clooney and Pitt and Michael B. Jordan, and he wants to be on more yachts. And it's just like, I don't know, the fact that he has such a good sense of humor about it, I do find extremely sexy. You know?
Don't you see, Paul? There's nothing sexier than humility.
He's already on sexy yacht parties with Clooney and Pitt. I mean, you know what I mean?
Right.
He's not like some guy, like, you know, who's in human resources. Like, he's already an A-list celebrity. He gets invited to those things. Like,
right.
You know.
I don't know. I mean, but he is like a weirdo.
It's nice that he's self-aware and can actually, like, throw down some jokes like that.
Yeah.
I was like, is there a Sexiest Woman Alive thing? Mm. I looked it up, at People Magazine did it once. One year, Kate Upton was the Sexiest Woman Alive, and they never did it again. And the idea of Sexiest Woman Alive feels icky and unnecessary to me. But why is it that Sexiest Man Alive doesn't?
Really, Dan, you're going to complain about the objectification of men in this one specific instance? You don't think women are objectified enough, dude?
Yeah, because, Dan, every issue of every magazine always is Sexiest Woman Alive.
Yeah. That's fair.
I think we're looking at, like, the only privilege women have. This is, like, lady privilege. This is it, is that once a year, some magazine can name Sexiest Man Alive, and it's a little belittling and objectifying, you know, to one guy.
Fair enough.
We found it. So, Nagin, if you wanted to maintain the integrity of the Sexiest Man Alive, like, who do you think should have won it this year instead?
That answer is easy for me. I'm on an Oscar Isaac kick right now. Like, I watched Scenes from a Marriage and was able to, like, look through the internal pain into the hotness. And, that's who I would have picked hands down.
Oh, my God.
I'd vote for Chalamet.
I was going to say Chalamet, too. The problem with that is that he's only 25, and, like, that shit is going to go to his head, you know?
I mean, I think we've got to be there already, you know, vis-a-vis his head.
Oh, he is just so charming.
Yeah.
What is it about that young man? Okay, so our last story that we thought would be fun to talk about is this guy named MJ Eberhardt, also known as Nimble Will Nomad, finished out the final few miles of the Appalachian Trail. He became the oldest man to walk the entire trail. He is 83 years old. Okay, so what do you aspire to when you're 83? Have you thought about that? Like, is there something that you would really like to do when you're an old person physically that, like, you're thinking about now, Nagin?
You know, it's funny, like, so I live in New York City and I go to the East River Park a lot, and I see there's this dude there whose face looks like he's 150 years old, but his body, because he like will take his shirt off, is jacked, like he's totally ripped, and he does it through Tai Chi, that slow moving thing. And yeah, and so I want to be that guy, right? I was like, I mean, and I'm like not even that person now. I just, what am I expecting? I'm expecting to be ripped, but later in life.
I did a lady weightlifting thing for a while, and they talked a lot about how like you're going to squat until you die. You know, like every time you go to the bathroom, that's a squat. So like you might as well like get those glutes going, you know?
That's why I pee sitting down.
So, yeah, what about you, Dan? What's on your, like, 80-something fitness goals?
I mean, aside from just being alive, I would say number two would be being able to go for long walks. I just love walking. You know, yeah. I'm not an intense exerciser, but I need to move every day. I go for at least one brisk walk every day. I mean, if you can do that when you're 83, you're doing pretty well, I think.
I'd take it. Well, Nagin, Dan, I hope to talk to you before like 50 years from now, but I look forward to that chat too.
When we're 83 and we're doing communal squats.
It's going to be amazing, y'all. Just wait for it. Thank you both. This was so much fun.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Greta.
In just a minute, we'll take a deep dive into how supply chain problems are impacting the publishing industry. It's fun. We promise. I don't know about you, but the phrase supply chain was not one that I thought about a lot before the pandemic hit. But since then, it has come up in all sorts of surprising ways.
Blame it on the supply chain.
Shipping snarls.
Critical logjam. Chain of fools.
There are so many snags in the chain.
At this point, we've all heard about how supply chain strains are impacting stuff like furniture and clothes and toys and computer chips. But as the book nerd that I am, I have been noticing some problems for booksellers and publishers, too. Now, I haven't seen empty bookshelves at my favorite local bookstores yet, but I have noticed emails from publishers announcing delays. And the industry as a whole is definitely on edge.
Oh, it's bad.
Definitely a lot of emails from customers. Where are my books? Where are my books?
I've been in the business for 30 years, so it's probably as difficult as it's been.
What the heck is going wrong? We decided to dig into what's happening and how to prepare for it. We're going to start our journey with the first of many excellent book lovers.
My name is Sandra Law. I work for Abraham Associates.
Sandra is the Midwest representative for more than 30 smaller publishers, lots of university presses, and also Chronicle Books, which makes puzzles and notebooks and cookbooks, among other things. Sandra says there are issues at pretty much every step of the bookmaking process.
Yep, every single step.
So think about a baby book. Once it's written, it has to get printed, which obviously involves paper. And there is a paper shortage, but it definitely doesn't stop there. There are also fewer printers than ever before. Sandra says 98% of the books we read here in the United States are printed in China, which means if you're a publisher and you can find a printer and they can find paper and all the books you need do get made, that's great. But then you need a shipping container, and those are in super high demand.
It's a little wild. Shipping containers used to only cost around $2,500. Now some publishers are having to spend upwards of $25,000 just to get the containers. Yeah, I mean, it's wild.
In the before times, a publisher would just order a huge print run from one printer and get them shipped over. But now, because of all this chaos, publishers are trying to mix things up as much as possible to make sure they'll get their books on time.
One of my big books this fall is from Spike Lee. It's entitled Spike. It's coming from Chronicle Books. So they specifically made sure that they had three separate printings coming in on three separate vessels to give it the best shot on not having to push the sale date back too far. But they're still probably looking at least a week pushback of that on sale date, which that's honestly amazing compared to what I've seen with some other books.
Oh my God, that sounds so stressful. I mean, how, like, I don't know. I think about my own little life, like in my apartment in Chicago, and like how out of control things have felt for me over the past year and how stressful it is. But like, I don't have to worry about hundreds of thousands of books. You know, this is like people's livelihoods.
Yeah. As a rep, there's pressure. As a bookseller, there's pressure. But I would say, like, definitely as like a publisher operations person, oof, right. It's just not the time to have that job.
There aren't as many mills as there used to be. They've all shut down. They're going bankrupt. They're retooling for diapers. And everybody knows about the ships that are off the coast of California right now and off the coast of Boston. It's real.
That is Clark Matthews. He's the vice president and general manager of IPG Inc. He says it's the oldest and second largest book distributor in the country. It also just happens to be here in Chicago. So Nerdette producer Anna and I went to check it out.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Welcome.
Great to meet you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. Come on in.
At IPG, there is a giant room filled with industrial paper cutters and conveyor belts and massive rolls of paper and huge printers. There's a warehouse, too. It holds about 12 million books. Most of the books there are shipped in from other printers, but Clark says they print about 10% of their book stock in-house. At least they do when the printers are actually working. Oh, I see a red light. That's probably not good, huh?
Red light means no good. In the bowels of this machine, an important belt broke. And that important belt cannot easily be replaced.
Is that partly because supply chain?
Yes. Our technician is going to another site and stripping an existing machine somewhere else of that part and putting it on this machine.
Clark says that is not the only supply chain issue that he can easily point to. The systems they never had to question before are totally falling apart. And for him specifically, it's mostly coming down to paper and glue.
There's just not enough supply.
As a result, Clark has found as many workarounds as he can.
You know, my supply chain is stronger now than it's ever been because I've got a plan B and a plan C for everything.
Booksellers are trying to think about their plans B and C, especially now as people start buying gifts for the holidays.
It's going to be an issue for sure. Don't ignore it.
Javier Ramirez co-owns and runs Exile in Bookville. It's an indie bookstore here in Chicago. And only about half of Javier's shop sales actually come from new books. They sell used books, too. So he thinks he'll be safer from shortages than the stores that rely solely on shiny new releases.
I think it's those big titles, you know, like the Sally Rooneys and the Colson Whiteheads and the, you know, the Jonathan Franzens. And I think that's where bookstores are going to be impacted.
And the impact is really going to be felt by someone who waits until the last minute to do any holiday shopping.
Somebody's going to walk in looking for a gift for their uncle who loves military history, nonfiction. And he's going to get a book on how to press flowers, you know, and he's going to have to be happy with that.
So essentially what Javier is saying is that customers are going to have a plan C too. And who knows, maybe instead of the history of the Panzer tank, Uncle Dave will get really into pressing pansies. While the holidays represent a major hurdle for everyone along the book supply chain, every person we talk to agrees this is probably only the beginning. Here's Sandra again, our publisher rep.
The issues that we're facing definitely started last year, and they are just continuing to get worse, unfortunately. Every week, we kind of find out new things that are impacting delivery of books to the warehouses and then from the warehouses into the bookstores. So that has pushed so many on sale dates back.
And Clark at IPG says he's not even looking for a light at the end of the tunnel.
This is the new normal, in my opinion, for sure.
Yes, he is stressed, but he also seems kind of thrilled by the opportunity to get creative and do good work.
What people love about their jobs in general is the problem-solving part, right? So it's kind of a perfect storm for being happy, at least in my opinion. It's so fun. I spend all day long now on the phone with paper people, glue people. I've met so many funny little companies in Chicago. Guys that have a one glue reactor. The guy comes out, it's just him and his undershirt, and he's got his bucket of PUR glue he can give me. And you know, in his factory, it's like a tiny little box, and he's got the one little van. This is ventilation. He's like, oh, I got some glue for it. You know, it's like, it's been really fun.
And our bookstore owner, Javier, agrees that the supply chain disruptions present a very real challenge. But he says that could also be an invitation for booksellers to do what they do best.
I mean, if we've been touting this about ourselves as independent bookstores and better than Amazon, I think that we're going to have to prove that that's why we are who we are this holiday season.
Indie booksellers are amazing. Like, they can hand sell, they can help you find that perfect book or item. Use them, because, you know, realistically, what you're looking for, unless you've pre-ordered, might not be available when you go to buy it.
So, pre-order as much as you can. Also, be flexible about what books you are giving and receiving this holiday season. In other words, be a good book nerd citizen. And hey, flower pressing is kind of awesome. All right, that's it for this week. Hey, we are doing a special episode next week. We would love your help for it. Many of you already know Emily Landon. She is what we like to call Nerdette's resident epidemiologist, and we check in with her now and then about COVID stuff. We would love to know what your questions are for her. You can just record yourself on your phone and email the file to nerdettepodcast@gmail.com. If you have a question but don't want to use your voice, that's totally fine. Just send us an email. We are talking to her on Tuesday, so do it before Tuesday, and maybe you'll hear your question in next Friday's episode. The show is produced by me and Anna Bauman. Our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak. We will see you next week.